They always say it's darkest right before the dawn. We can see light, but is that a truck? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Yeah, Barry, it's great to be back with you here in the in our little fortress where we are. We have built this rampart against the coronavirus, and we seem to be winning. And if you think that's a joke, it's because it is. It's a bad one, but it's a joke. So yeah, everybody's fine here. I'm hearing that everybody's fine there. Although you didn't say so, but you did off air. So I'm glad to hear that. It's a beautiful day today. But on the day before tomorrow night, it's supposed to be 26 degrees here.
We're expecting somewhere. Well, last night they were expecting freezes. Tonight they're expecting freeze warnings. And yes, that's right, folks. It is the middle of, going into the middle of May. Welcome to living in the Midwest, where spring is followed by winter, is followed by summer, is followed by winter again.
Yeah, it just depends. You know, the only place worse, as I've said before, is Michigan. This is colder than it has been, and you know, we've had several warm springs in a row. I still have to laugh because people were talking about global warming pops up every once in a while, but then it goes to climate change when you have weather like we're having right now. And the reason has nothing to do with anything. We're at sunspot minimum right now. And during sunspot minimum, you normally find that the global temperatures are a little lower. There are a number of theories about that. I think the cloud cover theory is the one. We've been at very low sunspot activity for now 3 sunspot cycles.
And it's possibly, yes.
Yeah, I think that's right. At least two. Not shockingly, we've seen very low sunspot activity. Well, why is that? Well, the sun goes through these periods. It goes through quiet periods, and everybody panics, and you do end up with some, you know, weather-related things. Hard winters. And we didn't have a hard winter. We had a relatively warm winter, but we've had a terrible spring. I think it was warm. Yes. It was warm in March, and then it cooled right off, and it has stayed cool. Now, people say, oh, it's unprecedented. Nah. I couldn't remember this, Barry. I bought in 1978 or 9. I can't remember the exact year. 1978 or 79. I bought an MGB. I was a young man. I think I was 20 or 21, 22, somewhere in there. And I bought this MGB. It was a great car. Loved it. Girls liked to ride in it. And I like riding around with the top down, all that stuff. You know, it was a little, if you know what that is, it's a little 2-seater convertible car, British. It would hold a curve like a dream. Oh, let me tell you, that car, it maneuvered like you wouldn't believe. In any case, I bought it in May, thinking, oh, in a week or so, I'll be able to put the top down, drive around. Nope. Mid-June, I think I got the top down twice in early June. And mid-June, it was warm enough that I could ride around with the top down, because it got into the high 50s, low 60s. Well, you can ride around in a car with the top down at 58 degrees, but it's not pleasant. Some people love it. The British always rode around in open vehicles, and that's up to them. But, man, you got a bundle. So this is not unprecedented. Now, I'm hearing now that if we have snow tomorrow on the 8th of May, it will be the first time that there's been snow this late since 1966, I think, is what I read. Don't take that as gospel, folks. Go do your own research. But I think 1966. Now, I forget what the date of the last average date of frost here is. I can tell you what it is in Michigan, because I worked in an agricultural department when I was there. It's Memorial Day weekend. It's May 25th. It's the last average day of frost in Michigan. Now, that includes the Upper Peninsula. So the UP is two seasons. You've all heard that old joke, right? Winter and the 4th of July.
Yep.
It is very much cooler up there. Although I've been up there, I was up and once at the end of October to help pull a boat out of the water at my uncle's place. And he had a place in Curtis, which is on the Manistique Lakes. And, it was 82 degrees Saturday [S2] Yeah. [S1] When we were pulling the boat out of the water. And, you know, I was in the water and it was warm and everything. By Sunday afternoon when we were going home, the temperature had dropped about 30 degrees. Uh-huh. And the wind was blowing about 55 miles an hour. And as we're driving across Route 2, there are places where you can see the lake and it's all churned up. Well, you have to go over the Mackinac Bridge. Wind 50 miles an hour. They, if you have a trailer, they escort you over the bridge. And they escort you over the bridge at about 20 miles an hour. Now, we drove over that. I was driving. I can tell you this. I do not like that bridge. There are two ways you can go.
I can gather that.
Yeah, you can go two ways on that bridge. You can drive on the outside lane, where, in my opinion, the safety rail is way too low. Or you can drive on the inside of the bridge, where you can see through it. And so,
right.
It's an open grid. I'm like, and plus the air comes up from underneath. So I'm like, first of all, they set a speed limit of, I think, 30 to go across when the wind's that high. Sometimes they'll close the bridge because this is way off topic. When I was living there, they had a confirmed case of a car going over. Now, can you guess what kind of car it was that went over the bridge? In a high wind, like 60-mile-an-hour wind, 50-mile-an-hour wind, something like that.
An MGB.
Nope. It was a Yugo.
Okay.
A Yugo went over with an unfortunate woman in it.
Yeah, that's sad.
Yes. I'm like, she was on the outside lane, and I'm like, that railing is too low. I'm sorry, it just is. Now, they've had trailers go over. People who are dragging U-Hauls and travel trailers, you know, fifth wheels and that kind of stuff. And those have gone over. But that's the only time I believe that a car with an individual in it has gone over. And that's a frightening thought, because that's a long way down. And it's really deep there. And I think they didn't get her out of the water until the following spring. So, there's your scary thought for the day.
That is a little on the scary side.
Yeah, I'm no kidding. Sorry.
But you know what? It's kind of going to carry a theme because, you know, a lot of what we're going to be talking about today is going to be scary to some people. It might even actually be scary to us. You never know. but, you know, Chuck, here we go. We're another week. We're, like I said, we're already into May. We're recording this is May the 7th. It's the National Day of Prayer. But we're not going to have the gatherings at the State House lawn. We're not going to have the gatherings at the courthouses because we're still here in Ohio, at the very least, under the directives and orders of the State Department of Health Director Amy Acton and through her mouthpiece, Governor Mike DeWine, who basically have decided that, we're not telling you that you have to stay at home. We're not telling you to shelter in place. We're telling you to stay safe until the end of May, until May 29th was when the order came out. But you know what, Chuck? and we talked about this a little bit. We didn't go into details, I don't believe, in the last program. The new order that came out, that because remember on May 1st, which was last Friday, which was the day after we recorded last week, on May 1st was supposed to have been when the order expired for
right.
all of the sheltering in place, stay at home, blah, 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 and we're going to start opening things back up. Well, funny thing happened on the way that afternoon on Thursday. Guess what? Governor DeWine comes out and rolls out that, we're not doing a shelter in place order anymore. We're doing a stay safe order, which is, verbal political semantics, basically saying the same thing but trying to convince you it's something different. Basically what they did was they extended the order until the 29th of May. Yes, that's right, after Memorial Day weekend. And, along with saying that, on Friday, certain things could open, and then this week, certain things like construction and others could start back in. And next week, Chuck, I think, unless they change their mind between now and over the weekend, on the 12th, most retail businesses are supposed to be able to open back up. Now, of course, they can't just open back up. They have to open back up following their doctor's orders, and the part of those orders include requiring face masks to be worn by their employees. Now, originally, DeWine was going to require face masks to have to be worn by all the customers until he got a lot of pushback, and then he backed off on that again. But then he flipped it back around and said, it's up to the businesses to be responsible, and if they want to require their customers to wear masks, then they can. Oh, and by the way, if you don't follow our regulations as a business, we control your, through the Department of Commerce and other places, we control your licensure. So, hey, you can put two and two together there, Chuck, and figure out what's going on. It's not a direct mandate for the citizens to wear masks, but it's an indirect mandate to get the businesses to force the citizens to wear masks in their businesses.
Yeah.
That's going to get some pushback, obviously. But the one group that's really hung out to dry here right now are the restaurant businesses. And I'm not talking about, the big ones who did the carry and stuff. I'm talking, the small mom and pops, things of that nature. Because there's no real clear timeline yet for when they get open back up. Now, I had heard somebody had put out something they think it's going to be, the 15th or the 16th of this month. I haven't heard that yet. Hopefully, if they're going to, the governor, but what will end up happening is, and as we're seeing in other states with the restaurants, you can open back up, but you can only open back up at 25% of your capacity. You can only open back up if you require everybody to wear masks. And Chuck, how do you eat when you're wearing a mask?
Yeah, it's absurd. Yeah.
It's absurd. I mean, it's incredibly absurd. And you have to, reconfigure your entire dining area so that the tables are more than 6 feet apart. Now, Charles, okay, you and I have both been to a lot of different type of restaurants. How do you think if a restaurant, an average restaurant, moves their tables in their dining area to more than 6 feet apart from each other, and that's 6 feet in every direction, Charles, that's 6 feet vertically and horizontally. Do you think that they're still going to be able to maintain 25% of their operating capacity?
No. Look, I had a friend who grew up in the restaurant business.
Well,
and,
yes.
And one Easter Sunday, I was in a church that had a lot of college students and it had a lot of foreign students. And a lot of people couldn't go home for Easter. So Jenny and I opened up the doors of our home and we invited everyone over for Easter. We had a little porch that it was a little screened-in porch, and we put it. It was just warm enough that we could all be out there, and we set it all up so that we got everybody in there. We had 30 people in this little screened-in porch that was probably about 12 feet deep and maybe a 15 or 18 feet wide. And this guy was an expert. He knew how to do it. And he set it up mm-hmm. because he'd been in the restaurant business. They know
right.
how to cram as many seats comfortably
right.
in the smallest area possible.
You got it.
They know how to do
it. Let me guess. But if you have to do 6 feet by 6 feet in every direction, and think about it this way, Chuck, there's nothing that says that they can't have the local health department come in and say, well, you know, at a table, the people have to be 6 feet apart from each other, too. Which means if you have a four-top table, what does that maximize your number of people at that table?
Right. Right.
Two. At the best.
Yeah.
At the best, two per four-top, or one person per two-top table. So not only are you reducing the number of tables probably by about 70% in the restaurant, then you're reducing that 30% by half, minimum.
Yeah. Oh, minimum. So minimum.
You're looking at. They're telling them they can operate at 25% capacity, but you're telling them they can only have about 10 to 15% capacity actually physically present in their restaurant.
Yeah.
How many restaurants are going to be able to pay their bills, pay their utilities, which don't stop, pay for the increased cost of food because, as you know, from all these stupid stay at place orders and shutdown orders, we've now disrupted the food chain. In the U.S., the food processing and distribution chains are out of whack. Go to the store. Can't find chicken, can't find most beef, barely can find any pork. Guess what, folks? This is all because of the overreaction of politicians to not wanting to have a bad day in the press and be blamed for tens and hundreds of thousands of deaths on their watch in their state.
Okay.
Which didn't occur, wasn't going to occur, and was the fever dream of people that we now find out, Chuck, and this is another little story, and we'll talk about this later, we now found out that the main driver of the models that everybody based their thing on wasn't following their own advice because they were busy carrying on a sexual affair with a married woman, yes. And they were breaking their stay-at-home orders and their curfews in order to go out and have an illicit tryst.
Neil Ferguson.
During the shutdown.
Yeah,
Neil Ferguson, who's the guy who developed the model, the original model, from the,
Imperial College.
The Imperial College. I keep thinking of Royal Academy. It's Imperial College.
You're not far off.
The Imperial College, the guy who came out with the model that Dr. Acton based her nightmare doomsday scenarios on, that Governor DeWine immediately knee-jerked and started, you know, threatening everybody who wouldn't comply with not being good Christians, etc. That's what he said about the churches opening up. Here we go. This is like one sham after another, and what we've got right now is, even if they do open the restaurants back up, for most restaurateurs, you know, okay, if we open back and say we can only do this, how long is that going to happen? Because we can only pull in 10% of your regular revenue and try to open your restaurant back up, and then your bills start hitting and all your costs go up because the cost of food goes up.
A restaurant can't reopen if it can only
have
20.
They can't reopen under those conditions.
No, they can't. Because everybody's sitting around waiting for them to reopen. They can't. I want to go in a place. I want to go, and I tell my wife this. She's like, let's just get it to go and go home before this all hit. And I'm like, no. I want to go into a restaurant and sit down and have a young person come in and give me my food and ask me if there's anything else I need, like condiments and, you know, other goodies and that kind of thing, and eat it in the place. I like the atmosphere. I like, even if I don't know anybody, I like getting out and seeing people. I don't necessarily want to interact with people, but that's an entirely different thing. Like, for instance, we like to go to, there's a steakhouse here on Church Street in Newark. We go in there, the place is packed. I mean, packed, packed, packed to the gills. If there aren't that many people in there, it's just not worth it. For the business owner, they're doing all they can to keep their noses above water by taking takeout orders.
Yeah.
But the fact is that they can't survive by having 25% of their normal capacity in one of these big box walk-in restaurant stores. It can't happen. It can't be done.
You're right. Can't be done. It's not physically and it's not economically possible.
No, it's the economics.
And I'll tell you what, if we get to the point, Chuck, okay, what happens? We get to the point, let's say that 15% of the restaurants that were around before the first week of March have to close permanently because of this. So 15% of the restaurants. In Ohio, that's a pretty significant number. And if those numbers go down, then that means that, you know, again, it has a ripple effect. If they're not ordering the meats, then the processing plants aren't running at full capacity, and the farmers who are raising the livestock, you know, won't be able to take as many to market, or they won't be, or they'll take them to market and they'll get pennies on the pound instead of dollars, because the demand will be lower. Well, will the demand be lower in the stores? Well, they won't be for a little bit, because now that everybody's experiencing a shortage, there'll be the overreaction of buying up as much as you can ahead of time, and, you know, just to avoid, you know, when you can't get it at all. And that spiral of economic malfunction, I guess is the best way to put it, just continues to get tighter and tighter. But at the same time, you know, our good paternalistic governor, Mike DeWine. And folks, if you paid any attention over the last 5 or 6 weeks to DeWine, you start realizing something. The man thinks he's like your grandfather and he's giving you wise sage advice because he knows better than you about everything in your life. Chuck, have you ever had a relative like that can tell you everything that you should do in your life?
Oh gosh, are you kidding?
and the point is that, frankly, their opinion is just based on what they want. It isn't based upon anything that's actually beneficial for you. It's based on what makes them more comfortable. This is Governor DeWine. He's basically throwing this stuff out here because, well, let's just be quite honest, he doesn't want to have a bad day in the press. He likes all the accolades and the New York Times and Time Magazine and Newsweek talking about how he was, you know, such a wonderful, bold governor to shut everything down. Well, you know, now that the shine has worn off the dime there a little bit, and people are starting to feel the impacts of all of the shutdown, you know, even the folks who didn't get shut down, who were in essential work or who could work from home, you know, the pajama patrols. I'm among those. I'll just say it. I'm among those. I probably did a half of my Zoom meetings in my pajamas. but the point is that now everybody else is going to start feeling the pain. It isn't just the people who were initially unemployed. Oh, and by the way, Chuck, just since we've been keeping up on this, just to let you know, the latest unemployment numbers for Ohio just came out again. Interesting thing here, Chuck. You'd think that now that we've, you know, flattened the curve and we've made the peak and we've gone over the edge and we're down on the backside of the waterfall on this, right? That things would all get better. And if, you know, you want to read this one way, yeah, things got better because, wow. There was a drop off of 32,000 unemployment claims this week, this last week versus the week before. That's great, right?
What's the other shoe?
Not necessarily.
Yeah,
not necessarily, because some of those are not drop offs because people went back to work. They're drop offs because people got tired of waiting and trying. That people got told that they didn't qualify because, you know, they didn't have enough hours in, or et cetera. But we had this initial claims for unemployment list during this last reporting period of a week was 61,000 new claims, Chuck.
That's new claims.
But that's a drop off of 32,000 from the week before when we had almost 100,000 claims. But here is the deal, Chuck. In the last 7 weeks since the shutdown began, the numbers for filing unemployment claims are 1,118,569 in 7 weeks, folks. 1.118 million people out of work in Ohio.
Yeah, that's 10% of the Ohio population. Yeah,
that is 10% of the Ohio population.
But that's not
represents a large chunk.
Yeah.
Of the employable.
I was going to say that.
Now let me give you a benchmark so that you understand this number, folks. All right, The Department of Job and Family Services, who keep these numbers, have also reported that the combined total of unemployment claims for the previous 3 years combined, so before this broke out, so the, from the previous 3 years, the total of claims was 1.117457. So that's 1,117,457. So in 7 weeks, Chuck, we have surpassed the number of unemployment claims that they had for three calendar years previously.
Yeah. Yep.
And when you factor out seasonal unemployment in that three-year total, because you have a lot of seasonal employment around the spring when everybody's pulling in the migrant workers for crops and things, and in the fall when everybody's pulling in the extra help for Christmas. So that unemployment number, if you adjust that out, because if you think about it, Chuck, this started mid-March and goes through now to May. That all that seasonal stuff had been off to the wayside, except for maybe the, you know, coming in with the stuff for planning. That's a huge number. 1,118,000 in 7 weeks. It's more than we had in the last 3 years combined. And we have spent more than $1.9 billion in Ohio in unemployment compensation payments in that 7 weeks.
Okay, and how's the governor handling that?
Well, we can't quite tell most of these people when they're going to get back to work.
He's already making strong hints that we need a tax increase.
Well, of course they do, because you know that is the forte of a progressive leftist we can't cut government spending now, and I'm going to talk about where he is cutting government spending, but trust me folks, that's only a temporary holdback until he can use that as a springboard to try to raise your taxes. So you know that's what we're looking at here. He's already talking about that. Well, because gosh, we got to fund those schools, Chuck. You know, those schools that now they're talking about the potentiality of only doing 2 days a week and the other 3 days would be via the distance learning, et cetera, the electronic classroom stuff, and have two live days in the classroom. Now, the question is, Chuck, if that's the case and they're not using those buildings, there'll probably become a point where people will be like, well, why am I paying all these property taxes then? Because a large chunk of your property tax, I know for me it's 2/3 of my property tax go for school levies, and you may be yours as well. Well, you know, if they're not using those schools and they're just using electronic technology, then why am I going to continue to pay property taxes to bolster up a building, a brick and mortar, and all the expenses around it that you're not using? And if coronavirus is such a horrible thing that you're scared to death of these kids catching it, why are you going to pull them into the classrooms 2 days a week? Is the social distancing going to be, well, if you just go every other day, you won't catch it? I don't get that.
Okay, you don't get it because it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's essentially, this is not about stopping a virus. This is about maintaining control. Now
isn't that the case?
Yeah, we've been saying this since March 14th, our first show on this subject. And the fact is that we're going to open it just for limited contact. No. Look, the whole point is that once you start contact, now, look, people keep saying, well, once we open back up, the deaths are going to spike. And I'm like, yeah, they will for a while. And that's going to happen. Why? Because you can't stop it. All you're doing basically now, it's like a pressure cooker. You've got the fire going underneath, you got the lid bolted down, and you can see the pressure building inside. If you suddenly release that pressure, what happens? Big explosion, right?
That's right.
Well, that's what you're doing. All the people that who have all the right stuff to get the virus, they haven't been exposed, and oh, by the way, here's the problem with the argument I'm about to make. The most recent studies are saying that people are getting it that are just staying home. the same people, you know, people are the stay-at-home thing.
Yes.
In states where there is no stay-at-home order, the rates of infection are exactly the same. Most of those states are more rural states. I'll grant you that. And I would also reply, so what? Now, in New York City, where people are stacked on each other and there are, you know, 28,000 people per square mile. That's a lot of people per square mile, by the way. That's a whole lot of people per square mile. They're right on top of each other. But nonetheless, once you get people out and mixing around, some people are going to get it. Now, here's what the really ugly part that people aren't getting. And we talked about this way early, I think on the 14th or the 21st of March, we talked about how the virus mutates. As it moves through people, it picks up mutations. And generally speaking, as it mutates, it becomes less deadly. If you remember the SARS outbreak, do you remember SARS from a few years ago?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact.
That's what happened to SARS. SARS essentially mutated out of business.
And it took about 5 months.
Yeah. And it mutated so fast that it just became a non-entity. That's actually what happened to, you know, people keep waiting for this comeback of the 1918 flu bug. How many times have you heard that in the past? Oh, this could be a repeat of the 1918 flu bug basically mutated itself out of business around, it kept coming back, and every time it came back, it was less virulent. And I think it finally disappeared around 2010. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that was a coronavirus.
Yeah.
And this is what happens. So what we're really doing is keeping this virus from mutating to a less deadly form. Now, it's doing it anyway. Although some people are claiming it's getting more virulent, it's not. It's becoming less and less and less. We can see that. Look, Barry, these people like Dr. Acton and Fauci and Birx are patting themselves on the back for the social distancing fixing this. That can't be the case. It can't be, mathematically. Because the estimation was it took 22 days for the curve to flatten. The curve started flattening about 8 or 10 days into social distancing, and yep. it flattened dramatically. If you'll recall, the nightmare scenarios with Andrew Cuomo, we'll need 40,000 ventilators. They didn't need 10,000 ventilators.
That's right.
All across the country, and it really had nothing to do with social distancing. Now, is New York City still a hot spot? Yes. And I'm going to bring another thing up. Now, a couple weeks ago, 10 days ago, maybe even last week, you were hearing test, 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 test. We got a test, we got a test, got a test, got a test.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hearing that?
Yes, you were hearing that.
Are you hearing that so much now?
Well, not hearing it, but they're still making plans. There's still an ad out there from the Ohio Department of Health director where they're looking to hire canvassing people to go out and basically come and knock on your doors and check you out to make sure that you're not out there carrying it around.
Unless they're going to draw blood or take swab, it's meaningless.
It's meaningless. That's right.
All they're going to do is ask you a bunch of questions. Did you have this? Did you have that? Now, they're going to ask you a bunch of questions about, did you have a runny nose? Did you have a cough? Did you have this? In the middle of allergy season. Well, of course, thousands of people are going to say, yeah, I had all that. Yeah, well, my allergies are kicked up right now. Not so bad. I've managed to keep them under control this year thanks to the cold weather. But that being said, you're not hearing the push to get out and get tested so much anymore.
No, you're not.
And there's a reason for that. And I hate to...
Oh, because they don't have accurate tests?
No, that's not it. Although there are some things questioning the accuracy of the tests. I question those questions. And here's why.
Okay, there you go.
The more you test, the more you find out that people are exposed, they have the antibody, and they never had the symptoms. So what is that
in the first place? Yeah,
what's
right.
that doing to the death rate? It's driving it down, 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 down.
Oh, well, wait a minute. That doesn't fit the model, Chuck.
Exactly. It doesn't fit the model. That's what I'm saying. In New York City, they were claiming there was a 7.5% death rate. With better testing, they're finding out right now that it is 0.75%, and it is headed down in a plunge. That doesn't say the number of cases is heading down. The number of deaths per infection is plummeting down because they're doing testing and finding out that, gosh, a huge percentage of people never know they have it. And what does that do to if the models are all off by factor? We talked about it last week, factors of 30. Okay, let me tell you something. Going from 7.5% to 0.75% is a factor of 100.
Yes, that's right.
It's off by a factor of 100.
Yeah, but you know what's a factor of 100 between friends, right?
Well, look, here's something that a lot of people.
I mean, hey, come on, Chuck. They're doing this to save all of our lives.
People are still quoting that 69,000 people are dead from this thing, and guess what? The CDC just lowered the number.
Right. They had an adjustment based on the fact on getting the actual real data in and having to filter out a lot of supposed cases that when they did some research realized it had nothing to do with coronavirus, but they were reported that way. Now, Chuck, why do you suppose over 30,000 cases were reported to the CDC as corona-related deaths that weren't?
Oh, I know why. Because hospitals were being paid more money if they reported a coronavirus death.
Right, and why were they screaming for ventilators, Chuck? Because you were also paid a stipend if you used ventilators.
A ventilator, yeah.
You got paid more money for using a ventilator, whether it was medically necessary or not. And if you could somehow report on the death certificate that the death was related to corona in some way, or you suspected it was related to corona, then there was a payment. Now, Chuck, where'd all that money come from?
Well, it came out of the federal coffers.
From the coronavirus bailout bill.
The one that was supposed to go to all the people.
Yes, you put that in there.
That I don't know.
Nancy Pelosi,
yeah, okay.
Well, of course, because, Chuck, you know, you've got to give that stipend to the frontline healthcare, right? So that the frontline healthcare industry can write you big campaign checks. Because they're the ones making the money off of all this. Now, funny thing is that, you know, even with if you look at those, that 30,000+, I think it was 30, almost 31,000 that was adjusted downward from the CDC report, that would explain why hospitals are closing emergency rooms, why hospitals are talking about maybe certain hospitals, smaller hospitals having to close. It isn't because they're contaminated. It isn't because they were overwhelmed and they're out of equipment and they can't afford it. It's because nobody's coming to the hospitals because the big surges that they all prepared for didn't happen. And what is happening is that with the governor's directive and order, the health department and the governor's directive and order, they couldn't do other procedures because those were prohibited from being done because, well, hey, we're trying to save everybody's life by keeping everybody from being able to go and get surgeries that they might need in order to stave off, you know, greater threats to their life and health through not getting the surgery. I mean, honestly, Chuck, if I'm a person and I needed a hip replacement, I need a hip replacement because if I don't get a hip replacement and something happens while I can't get surgery on it, and let's say I fall and I crack my head open, I could die from that. So why isn't that hip surgery as important as, well, killing an unborn baby in the womb through abortion, which basically got a pass? It's just, again, it makes no sense. And that's been the big problem all along with everything that's been coming out of Columbus and the governor's office, is that all of these measures are based on three things. Number one, faulty data. Horribly faulty. Number two, it's based on the idea that somehow government is a better determiner of how to keep you safe and healthy than you are. Because number three, It's the ultimate underlying psychology of paternalism.
Yes.
That you elected me governor, that means that I am now your mother, your father, your grandparents, your nursemaid. I'm basically taking care of you. That's our problem, Chuck. We've got to go, and it isn't just Mike DeWine. I'm just pointing him out because we've got this firsthand experience with this in Ohio. It's Whitmer in Michigan. It's Ford in Pennsylvania. Just go down the list of all the states that have, it's Cuomo in New York. It's they all have this underlying psychological need to be an authority figure in everybody's lives and tell them what to do. Because they somehow mistakenly got the notion that being a public servant meant that the public was servant to you. That's not how it works. Now, problem is, Charles, that what are you going to do about it? When you get someone who gets the psychology of wanting to be everybody's grandfather and give them all good advice and tell them how to live their lives, well, there's really got to be a way to curb that. We call those things checks and balances. In the Ohio right. Constitution and in our laws, there are things called checks and balances. Well, one of the checks and balances that the legislature is trying to do is to rein in the uncontrolled absolute authority of the Department of Health director to, A, declare a pandemic, and B, then to basically tell everybody what they can and can't do and shut down the economy or our elections, our schools, and everything else. Under the cover of, well, I told you it's not safe, so you have to listen to me. So this week, yesterday is my week. Like I said, we record on Thursday. This is on Wednesday. On Wednesday of this week, the Ohio House of Representatives met in session, Chuck. Interesting session. They sat 6 feet apart from each other. You had members up in the gallery. You had members out in the hallway, in the lobby. You had members strewn out all over the place, but basically all but I think three members of the assembly were there. Okay, so then 96 members there, and they all voted on a couple of bills. And the key bill that they voted on was a bill that was to do some regulatory reform for occupational licensing. So to get lower regulations on occupational licenses for people like hairdressers, salon, yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But they rolled in an amendment, and I thought it was a pretty good amendment because I got to talking about it with some of my folks, and some of them were like, "Why don't they just do a joint resolution, impeaching the governor or something?" And I'm like, "Well, first of all, it's a Republican governor and a Republican-led legislature. They're not going to impeach a governor from their own party.
It's
not going to happen. Die to that fantasy unless Lacey basically tries to abrogate the assembly and send them all home and act like a emperor. They're not going to try to impeach him. The second option they had was to pass a joint resolution, basically firing the health director saying that the health crisis was over. Well, problem with that is that they could pass it, but it would take another entity in order to enforce it, i.e. the courts. Well, what's been the record so far here in the courts in Ohio with dealing with striking back against the governor's power in this pandemic?
Well, unlike Wisconsin...
Which did a great job.
And if you don't know what we're talking about, they tried to do the same thing in Wisconsin they did here by essentially canceling the primary. In Wisconsin, they said no. Here they said, oh, sure, no problem. But you got to have the state legislature do it, which they created this monstrosity that cheat by mail.
That all happened. That's right. They did it as a stopgap. They created that problem. We've talked about that problem with the elections.
Yeah. And by the way, New York did the same thing. A judge in New York basically told Governor Cuomo to walk away, and basically said, you are having the New York primary.
Yeah, well, and that's fine, and bravo to them too.
Yes,
and hopefully we can use those precedents as a way of making sure we don't have a mail-in general election in the fall. And I'll talk about some of that in a minute, too, if we've got some time, because it looks like Frank LaRose is starting to head that direction. Our Secretary of State, Republican Secretary of State, starting to mouth a lot of the talking points of the leftist Democrats about, well, we need to have some changes here before we get into the fall. We'll talk about that in a minute. But okay, but the third thing the legislature could do, and it's what they did do, Chuck, their amendment basically said you can issue an order under 370113 in declaring a health emergency, but that order only lasts for 14 days, period. That's the maximum amount of time it can last. And if you want to do anything else, extend it or anything else, you have to go before the Joint Committee on Agency Rule Review, which is a legislative body that's made up of 5 House members and 5 Senate members. It's 3 Republicans, 2 Democrats from each of the 2 chambers. So it's 10, and you have to get at least 5 votes, you know, in order to approve a rule, that you basically have to go before JCAR in order to get an extension or to issue another order under the health crisis. So the Department of Health would have to come in and prove to legislators why they needed it. And if if JCAR refused to approve it or disapproved it, then the order died and the health crisis was over. It's a pretty clean way of doing it. It gives legislative oversight to a panel that's supposed to have oversight over the executive branch rulemaking powers, which you can call them orders all you want to. These are also, you know, they're not making standing rules that go into the administrative code. These are orders. But they're treating these type of orders like they're rules, and they're going to allow legislative oversight. Now, that's great, right, Chuck? I mean, it's like I said, there's no perfect solution. And none of those 3 that I laid out are foolproof. But of the 3, the JCAR route is probably the most likely to be able to, A, be responsive enough in a short time window in order to actually effectuate making some decisions. B, puts people who are actually directly elected responsible for making those decisions. Therefore, they're responsible to the voters. And C, gives clarity that the executive power only stretches so far and can't stretch beyond and can't be used to do things like, oh, I don't know, close all the polling places around the state in order to stop an election from happening. You won't have those kind of things because JCAR won't allow that to happen. Now, am I saying it's going to be perfect? No. I know full well it's not perfect. It's a political process. Now, the problem is, it may not even happen. Why? Well, because when they voted, Chuck, yesterday with those 96 of 99 House members, every last single one of the Democrat members voted against that provision. Why? Well, let me quote the minority leader of the House of Representatives, one young lady by the name of Amelia Sykes, who's a representative from Akron, who she herself is a prodigy. Her mother and father have both held her House seat, and her father sits in the Senate right now, in the Senate seat from Akron. They're a family dynasty of politicians who have basically held a elective office, probably combined total, for the last 30-some years. Okay? So just to give you an idea of who Amelia Sykes is. But this is what Amelia Sykes said on the floor when she gave her floor speech opposing the amendment to allow the elected officials of the state of Ohio to have oversight and the ability to curb the executive branch and its overreach. She said, quote, "The Ohio Department of Health has had quarantine and isolation power since it was established in 1886. And she's right in part. Let me step aside. But the section of code that she's using right now, the 3701.13 in the Ohio Revised Code, has been around since 1908, okay? So it was done in relation to a tuberculosis outbreak, Chuck, just to put that in your head.
Yeah.
And, of course, was in effect during the Spanish flu pandemic and others, including SARS, which you mentioned earlier. Okay, so going back to this is Amelia Sykes, quote, it says, "And its director has never before needed JCAR oversight until that director in charge of a pandemic was a woman. A woman who has gained national praise for her prudent and quick response to the coronavirus pandemic and whose decisive actions have saved Ohio lives," unquote. This is Amelia Sykes. Folks, the minority leader, and I mean minority leader in the fact that the Democrat caucus is the smaller caucus in the two chamber in the House of Representatives. They don't hold the power. They're the minority caucus. But she herself is a minority. She's both black and female. Although females are 51% of the population, so I don't see where we still say women are minorities. But that's okay. But what she did, she just threw out the gender card. The gender card. She just did an ism, Chuck. It's all about isms now.
Yes.
Because she's playing identity politics. It is the part parcel purview of the progressive left. Everything is identity politics. It's either by your sex, your gender, your ethnicity, or your socioeconomic status. Everybody's an ism. You know, everything you do in response is a negative ism. You're a sexist. You're a homophobe. You're a transphobe. Whatever it might be. Yeah, it's phobism and ismisms. So that was the height of their opposition to this bill, was because you're just doing this because she's a woman. No, this has to be done because the executive branch of government abrogated a constitutionally reserved power of the legislature in the respect of the elections. Because only the General Assembly can set an election and postpone an election if necessary. Not the executive, not the Department of Health, but that's how they did it. They have abrogated the legislative authority by using the threat of pulling licensure from businesses in order to force them not to open and not to do business. Chuck, that's not the purview of the executive.
No, it's not. It's not. It constitutionally, listen, we've been saying all along, this is a power grab. It's a usurpation of legislative authority. Now, how does that happen in our society? It happens because the legislature doesn't want to take the responsibility and allows the executive to step in and take the heat. The governor did that. When re-election time comes, the governor did that. We couldn't do anything about it. Of course you could have. You simply pass, you get your members together and you pass resolution saying you can't do that, and you do it in a veto-proof way. Here, we're not seeing that now, though, are we, Barry? We're not seeing veto-proof majorities. Because,
well, here's the problem, Chuck. We could have had a veto-proof majority on this measure, because right now the House has 61
right.
Republican members, which means that there are 38 Democrats. That's how the numbers work out to 99. Of the number of Democrats, two Democrats were absent. Okay. So that left 36 of 38. But the final vote count on this bill was 58 to 38, I believe. I think I got that number right, with three absentees. Yeah, it's 58 to 37, because Don Manning, who was a member who died of a heart attack, his seat has not been refilled yet. So, okay, so we've got that laid out there. But the problem is that you had Democrats who were absent, but yet the Democrat caucus almost had enough votes for their full caucus. How'd that happen? It happened because two of the Republicans switched sides.
Yep.
Dave Greenspan from Cleveland and Gail Manning from Lorain County voted with the Democrats and with the governor in order to block the legislature from being able to rein in an out-of-control executive branch agency who has created the environment that may wreck Ohio's entire economy. Gail Manning and Dave Greenspan, both of whom, Manning, again, talk about these political dynasties, Chuck. In Lorain County, a Manning, her husband, her son, or she has held that seat for the last 24 years. Okay?
Well, it's almost like the stranglehold if you had the last name Brown in the 70s,
absolutely.
60s and 70s. Absolutely. Didn't matter if you were related to the person. If you had the name Brown, you got elected to office.
Dave Greenspan is over in the Cleveland area. He's in the Rocky River area. Well, the Rocky River area has given us such stellar conservatives like Jim Petro in the past. So we know what we're getting over there is most of the Republicans are basically Democrats who just run as Republicans.
Well,
Gayle Manning might as well be a Democrat the way she votes on everything. She votes against abortion restrictions. She votes against oversight of the health department. Here's the deal. You've got these Republicans, and fine, you can vote whichever way you want to. That's perfectly your purview. But when it gets right down to what those two just did, Chuck, in switching over and voting, it was 57 to 38 because there were two Democrats missing. The two Republicans went over to fill out to the 38, and it was and the Republicans with those two jumping over plus Don Manning not being there only could get 58 votes. So that's where it got down to. But in order to override a veto of a governor, which is coming, and as soon as they got done voting, the governor was out there saying he's going to veto the bill because he doesn't want any oversight of his health director except for him, and he's not giving oversight. He's basically letting her tell him what to do. It's a strange psychology there. But because Manning and Greenspan jumped over and voted with the leftist Democrats, who basically are trying to hold out to get all these election changes, which we're going to hopefully talk about in a minute if we don't run out of time, they have given the governor the ability to know he can veto the legislation without any repercussions.
Yeah, exactly. Don't worry about it.
Now, of course, what they also did was they gave the Senate, who's always been recalcitrant to buck the governor in any way, shape, or form, because usually when a governor is appointing people to agencies to fill when he's like rolling into a next term or at the end of his first term, those appointments usually come from sitting senators who are on their way out the door. So a lot of them are probably like, oh, well, we don't want to upset the governor because we want to work with him, wink, 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 so we can get an appointment. Including the current Senate President Larry Opoff, who has already signaled, oh, there's nothing we're going to do about the health director, da 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 da. You know, he doesn't necessarily disagree. She's done a bad job. I got news for him. Most of your constituents disagree with you. She's basically become an autocrat, or as we talked about, a technocrat.
A technocrat, yeah.
A technocrat earlier on, and that's a problem. That's a major problem. But again, so now the Senate is making noises, and of course, I don't believe that. I think that they canceled, and they're not even meeting today, where they could have been taking this bill up, which is a Senate bill. Like I said, it's Senate Bill 1, in order to concur on it. But I don't think they're going to concur, Chuck. I think they're going to wait till next week. They're going to come in, and then they're going to take it up, and they're going to refuse to concur and say they want to go into, yeah, I'm looking at the schedule right now. They are not scheduled today. They don't even have a session scheduled till next Wednesday. So at the very best, they'll vote to not concur on that bill next Wednesday, and then they'll have to call a conference committee, and then that conference committee will lose things in that amendment. We probably won't lose the entire amendment, but we'll lose a lot of the things in that amendment, like, oh, I don't know, the citizen's right to sue against the Department of Health for issuing orders that cause their businesses to fail.
Yep.
They'll strip that out of there.
Yeah, of course.
They'll move the 14-day window to, you know, 30, 60, 90 days, and they'll probably say that JCAR has to actually vote to invalidate it with a majority vote, which if you have to do it that way, then the five Democrats and you get like a rogue Republican on there, and pretty soon the health department can get exactly what they want to. Again, like I said, no plan was foolproof. This one's going to be even more foolish if it gets amended the way I think it'll get amended.
Yeah, well, we are out of time, Barry. And
that's why I figured as much. We'll talk about Frank LaRose and what he wants to try to do with Ohio's elections in the fall next week.
But can you have an influence on getting the right thing done? Yes, you can. Contact your state senators and state reps. And if you don't know who those are, go to the the website for the Ohio Ohio government.
Go to our website.
Yeah, go to our website. I'm pretty sure
we've got
that
link
there.
Go to our website.
Yeah, we do. That being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.